I'm Josh Cohen.
I'm Corey Gergen.
And I'm Molly Slavin.
And this is Technically Pop.
Today we're going to be talking about the HBO show Succession. Regular caveat here that there will be spoilers.
Yeah, the show just finished up its second season on HBO 2 weeks ago, a week and a half ago.
Sounds right.
And we're going to be talking about almost everything that happens. So if you haven't seen it, maybe take a pause on this and come back and hear us after you've caught up on the shenanigans of the Roy family.
Which will take you approximately 20 hours, but it will be 20 hours well spent.
Worth it.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. Succession is a show about family. It's a show about a family, the Roy family, but it's also a show about a family that never really acts the way that we expect a family to act.
Depending on your background, of course.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
If any of you are Murdochs, you may have a different read on this.
And we could debate on a different podcast the extent to which any family operates that way. But in the Roy family in particular, any kind of display of affection or vulnerability or request for support is typically met with humiliation, with mocking, with deflection. And I have a scene in mind that kind of shows how this works. And in this scene, Logan, the patriarch, is asking his son Roman to do something for the business. And it's sort of a bigger responsibility than Roman is typically asked for. And Roman says, I don't know that I can do that. And Logan gives him this like seemingly kind pep talk, sort of talks him up, tells him what he is good at and why those skills are useful for this job. And Roman reads this as a fatherly pep talk and turns the conversation to family issues, and Logan immediately mocks him for it.
Also, just to, I don't know, check, Marsha? Is she upstairs, or is that okay? Are you okay? Do you have someone that you can speak to about shit?
You want me to speak to a shrink? Yeah. You may want to screw your mother, but I am okay in that department, thank you.
Great, well, it's just nice that we can talk about these things. I'm gonna go.
One question to kick things off is just kind of how does this idea of family work in the show?
What's great about that clip is it really shows Logan and Roman in this moment of, as Corey's kind of mentioning, this transition from business to family. And as soon as, in a very awkward, uncomfortable way, Roman is like, hey, do you have someone to talk to? Immediately, Logan belittles him, mocks him, makes this joke about wanting to screw his mother, this Oedipal complex. He doesn't need a shrink. He's okay in that department. Logan is, he's a stone face. He's stoic. He's impermeable. He never lets his family in. And that clip, even though it comes, is that the finale?
I think it's the second to last episode.
Because
then he,
that's
Roman
right, that's
goes
right.
off to do this job, which he does.
That's right.
They're also not on a yacht in this clip.
Yes, that's true. That's right. So we're in the second to last episode. So we're pretty deep into this. And this is Roman trying to reach out to his dad, see if he's okay. And Logan just aggressively shuts that down.
Mm-hmm. It's like the second they move off of like a capitalist logic, they can't have anything resembling a conversation.
Yeah, and although I also think that part of it is Roman misreading Logan's business advice as fatherly advice, and it's partially, I think, the way that Logan navigates this business. I mean, the show, the first episode of the show centers around his 80th birthday, right? And the 80th birthday is supposedly the moment where he is going to give his business over to his oldest son, Kendall, but it becomes the moment where he yanks it back. And I think Logan is using this idea of family to his own business ends, and he wants the loyalty that comes out of the family, but then he doesn't want to give anything back.
It's
if that
almost
makes sense.
Yes, it's almost, I mean, you guys work on stuff earlier than me, so tell me if I am working at a high school level understanding of the 19th century. But it's almost a 19th century understanding of a family, right? Where you have kids to provide labor, right? Like, that's kind of what this is, or how it reads.
So there's a clip earlier, too, that goes along with this really well, where Logan, in the first season, is in a little bit of tension with his daughter, Shiv, and whether he's going to go to her wedding or not go to her wedding. And he and his team are talking about the PR surrounding this. And it's basically like, well, do you want to go? And it's like, no, I don't want to go, but we can't think of an excuse not to go. Well, we could say XYZ, right? We could say that you're sick. No, it makes me look weak. Well, we could say this. No, I'm just going to have to go. And it's like, so first of all, he can't admit that he wants to go to his daughter's wedding. And then there's this great line where one of the assistants is like, we've always pushed that you're a good dad. And he just kind of stares at her blankly. And she's like, because you are, of course. And it just, he has no frame of reference for even what that would mean. All he's thinking about is the PR of it. He can't wrap his mind around going to his daughter's wedding or being a good dad outside of the frame of the company.
Performativity.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
And but the way that you said it makes me think about it differently, because I read it exclusively as his fatherly duties to his children are strictly done for PR purposes. But you almost kind of suggested that the PR purposes are his way of getting at his affection. That, like, he needs the PR stunt as cover for doing what he should do as a father anyway? Am I hearing you right, or?
I don't think he's capable of love or affection. And this may be a disputed point. I don't think we've seen...
No, I'm not going to dispute you on that.
No, I think that's right.
In two seasons, we haven't seen Logan do anything where he shows altruistic...
there's not been the King Lear has not offered the jacket to the guy who is cold.
Exactly.
We've not had that moment.
And that the clip we looked at with Logan and Roman harkens back to the first season therapy sesh at Austerlitz, which is
another PR move, right?
Another PR move. They have to keep this idea that Logan's a good dad. It's a family run company. That's part of the branding. And in that therapy session with a very, very hilariously in-depth therapist who's trying to get them started, Logan just finally says, like, look, I've done everything for my kids. He gives this very packaged statement, and they all just kind of look at him and are like, you can see it on their faces, like, we have to agree with him even though this is blatantly untrue. And it's very uncomfortable, and they're all just kind of like, those are good words. I think Connor says that. They're basically all forced to agree that he's this benevolent patriarch, mm-hmm. and they love him so much. But he's basically abused all of them.
Yes.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes.
Physically or verbally or both at some point in the show or in the implied sort of, you know, history before the show.
Yes. Yes. I do wonder how much Logan has certainly been verbally and emotionally abusive to all the children throughout their life. But I do wonder if it's stopped short of physical abuse only because when he slaps Roman in the second season, he is very awkward, and it's mm-hmm. the closest thing we've seen approaching an apology, which I don't think he would offer if that had been a regular part of their upbringing.
That's interesting. So I think a couple of things.
And I wonder if that's the line he views as, like, that's the line you don't cross.
Well, we see him in the first season hit Kendall's son, his grandson.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that.
And Kendall, when he hits Roman in the second season, which is, I mean, it's instinctive in some ways, and he's not actually... So Jesse Armstrong makes the point about that scene that he's not mad at Roman. Roman just happens to be there. He says something kind of snide. He's actually mad at larger situations that are making it hard for him to hold on to his company, right? Mm-hmm. Roman is just like a target. But then Kendall immediately kind of jumps in the middle and is like, no, don't do that. And you get the sense it's like not the first time that as the oldest he interceded.
Yeah. And he,
all right.
He also, in season one, sexually assaults Shiv when Shiv goes to visit him when he's ill and he's in his bed.
And, oh, that's right.
And Marsha won't let anyone see him.
Yes.
And Shiv shoves past Marsha and goes into the room, and it seems sweet, and then he grabs Shiv's hand and puts it in his pants, I believe.
I absolutely forgot about that.
From and his stroke.
And it's there's something about the way that the show depicts his recovery from the stroke where you never quite know when he's actually not with it and when his not being with it is a useful ruse for him to perform. So there's another scene where he's mad at Kendall for something Kendall has done in the business, and he gets up and he goes and he pees in the corner of Kendall's office, right? And the show never answers the question of whether he did that because he knew he could or whether he just was out of it. But
does he know a hawk from a handsaw?
Right. And yeah. Yes. And Shiv recoils, right, is shocked and leaves the room. But there is another sort of form of physical abuse. The show never quite deals with the extent to which he knows what he's doing.
That's such a good point. At any moment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Throughout that first season, or the first half of that first season anyway, until he gets up and gives that speech, maybe.
Right. Yeah. I think that's fair.
But
it points to this larger preoccupation, I suppose might be the right word, but the show has with like what is real, what is genuine, and what is just artifice,
mm-hmm.
which is a really tough question because I don't know that we get clues from the show about what's being ironized and what's not, which is part of what's really cool and really interesting about it.
Yeah, and the artifice is not, in terms of the definition of this family, is not exclusively a PR stunt. It works within the family itself.
Yes. Right?
And so there's this episode in season two where they go to visit Dundee.
Yes.
Right?
Which Scotland. Is
the Scottish town that he, that Logan has immigrated from. And his children's understanding of his upbringing is much worse than what they actually see when they get there.
They had been under the impression that, like, he did not have indoor plumbing. What else?
Yes.
It was a very bootstrappy narrative that Logan had really come up from nothing.
And what they find instead is a, like, not a mansion by any means, but a perfectly reasonably nice house.
In a solidly middle-class neighborhood.
Yes.
If you have ever been anywhere in the United Kingdom, it is the most, it is the most average British home you've ever seen. Whatever you're picturing in your head is correct.
Is the place, yes. Yes. Yeah, and there was an earlier scene where Connor, who's the older son from a first marriage, like seemingly very genuinely says that he doesn't think he could ever understand his father until he shit outside. And then they get to this house and they say, he didn't shit outside.
Yeah.
And it's this myth is not just for the business, it's also for how this family operates.
Which is also, I mean, he's 81 years old at this point. Mm-hmm. His children are all completely grown adults. It's not as if they're lacking for funds. How is this the first time they've ever seen the house his father grew up in? Right.
Right. They do that thing where he hates being there, mm-hmm. right? Throughout the episode, Logan expresses his distaste for being there, which is either an in-universe reason for why they haven't been there before, or it's just the lie he tells them to keep them from going there. Right?
I think it's the second. Cards on the table.
Yeah, yeah, fair.
Yeah.
So just with this larger idea of artifice that we've been talking about, kind of within this family and within the show, one thing that I think the second season builds on from the first season is that there's a lot of conflicting motivations going on, and there's this intrafamilial struggle, and you know who's gonna succeed to helm the company. But in the second season, we get a few clear moments where we do see some truth kind of bleed through mm-hmm. the artifice. So probably one of the most notable moments in the season is this scene between Kendall and Shiv, so brother and sister, that Kendall seems to be, so he's relapsed. He's an addict, he's relapsed, and on top of that, his second bid to kind of seize the company from his dad has failed, and on top of that, he's been part of this manslaughter tragedy with a guy who worked at one of their estates, and they're swerving to avoid a deer, they go into the water, and this guy drowns, and the company basically covers it up. So that's kind of setting up the second season for Kendall. He's completely just shattered psychologically.
He also discovers in the early moments of the second season that the young man had managed to unbuckle himself from the seatbelt. So we learn that he was alive when he hit the water. So there's mm-hmm. this additional implication, rightly or wrongly, that Kendall believes he could have saved this young man.
So he's completely traumatized. He's guilt-ridden. And he essentially just goes back to being a child, and his father helps him out of the situation. And again, what's interesting is that Logan is not, he's not really showing affection for him. He's basically showing relief that he is spared this corporate takeover, or at least he thinks he is. But into the second season, Shiv is the one who now, the daughter, she seems like she's positioned to take over, but she feels like, oh, maybe it's Kendall because he's back working for the company after he'd been trying to initiate a leverage buyout with some other investors. And there's a scene where Kendall's basically like, it's not me, essentially saying, I am completely broken. And he says to her, I just ask that you take care of me, and they embrace. And it's this insane moment of earnestness and vulnerability in a show that basically has given us Artifice episode after episode after episode. And then by the end of the season, we get something very similar with Roman, where he's come back from this harrowing experience where he's been taken captive along with a bunch of other people in Turkey by these terrorists, paramilitary types. We never quite know.
They want a business deal, right? Yeah. That's the ultimate motivation.
It's intentionally vague.
It's intentionally vague.
It's intentionally vague.
It seems dangerous.
Yeah. And there's
it's not good.
There's legitimate fear for their lives. He survives this. He actually displays a lot of savvy in the business negotiations. They come back in the season finale. They're on this family yacht in the Mediterranean. And he says to his siblings, hey, maybe we could just talk like normal people, basically. And you really get this sense that he's grown, that we'll have to have an obligatory Bill Dungsroman pun here with his name. But he's really achieved like this greater savvy, this greater maturity. And as soon as he says that, Shiv and Kendall, his siblings, defense mechanisms go up. They just start talking in like little kid voices and mocking him. So these two moments we get, one, Shiv can't quite believe if Kendall is being sincere. We as the audience tend to read him as sincere. And then Shiv and Kendall basically belittling Roman because they are so, it's so ingrained that they're not going to be honest with each other.
Right. And more to, and also, Roman is the only one, with the possible exception of Kendall in this, at the Scottish wedding, who's ever, I think, been in anything resembling actual imminent danger, right?
Yeah.
And Kendall, Corey, you had pointed this out earlier to me, but there are just sort of guardrails around his life. Like, he's never actually placed in danger.
Yeah, so Kendall, and Kendall's addiction is established early in the show, even as he is set up as the heir to the business and the fortune. There are sort of whispers of the fact that he's a recovering addict or a recovered addict. And so it's sort of like Chekhov's drug addict, right? You know the relapse is coming at some point. And the way we expect that narrative to go is relapse into death, but his wealth and his family's wealth becomes this sort of set of guardrails. And so as he relapses, Logan starts putting cousin Greg, who we somehow haven't come around to mentioning yet.
Greg.
Damn tragedy.
Gregory.
Cousin Greg, who we will talk more about later, but one of cousin Greg's job becomes to keep an eye on Kendall. And then when he fails at this wedding and it leads to the death of this employee, Logan steps in and essentially doesn't quite come out and say it, but makes clear that he will make it disappear if Kendall comes back into his camp. And the deal at the end of season one that they make is that he will go to a treatment center. And that's where season two picks up. And at first, it's not clear how long he's been in this treatment center, but he is pulled out of the treatment center, right, to go do
I think it's only been a couple of days.
The timeline indicates he's been there max 48 hours.
Right, so it the season two opens on him like in this like beautiful hot tub, like it's like Iceland. It's some kind of like geographical marvel. This is a very expensive place that he has been in. He gets pulled out, and as he is being told that he's going to go do this press junket for his father's business, it becomes clear that he has only been there for 2 days. And this is one of the shocks of this. But then as he moves back into this business life every risk he wants to take gets circumvented by Logan, sort of without, sometimes with Kendall knowing, but not always. So Kendall wants to start driving a motorcycle, and instead he is given a motorcycle driver who he humiliatingly has to like get on the back of this motorcycle mm-hmm. with anytime he wants to go somewhere. He starts like doing petty shoplifting, and we learn later that Logan has been like sending people in to make this right after he leaves. There are a number of scenes where he climbs to the top of the building and he just looks over the edge in this very, in this way that sort of implies suicidal ideation. And at the end of that episode, he goes up there and there has been these like clear walls.
Plastic walls
so that, so clearly someone knew he was going up there and did that to prevent him from doing something like that. And
there's a scene in a helicopter, which... he is drunk with a romantic interest, and they take off, they get in this helicopter, and they're sort of giggling, and they accidentally kick something, and the helicopter takes off, they figure it out, and they land it, and it's fine, but I initially read that as, oh, okay, so someone is going to die in a helicopter soon, right? It's Chekhov's helicopter, but of course nothing happens.
We're still waiting.
And nothing will ever happen because Kendall lives his life with bumpers.
Yeah, or he does until the very end of season two.
Yes.
And so the sort of the shock, the twist at the end of season two is a mirror image of this scene from the first episode of the season where Kendall is once again given an opportunity to do press for the business. And he is supposed to go back to this question of family, it is decided that he is the blood sacrifice that is going to let the business recover from a series of misconduct and PR disasters. And instead of doing that, he instead implicates his father in everything. And he's able to do that, the show very strongly implies without quite saying, because Cousin Greg has been sent to keep an eye on him. Greg has these incriminating files that he has saved through a series of humorous scenes. And Cousin Greg is on the plane. It's a plane. It's not a helicopter in this case.
Unfortunately.
Is on the plane with Kendall. And Kendall says, you can go to the bathroom. I'm not going to kill myself while you're gone, which seems to suggest that Greg has been sent along to keep Kendall from committing an act of self-harm, essentially. And we're led to believe that on this plane ride, they have this conversation. They make this deal that lets Kendall get these documents that implicate Logan.
Josh might have to correct me on this because I grew up Catholic. I don't quite know my Bible, but it sort of inverts the Abraham and Isaac thing, right? Like Abraham's going to sacrifice Isaac,
yeah.
And then it's saved at last moment. There's like a deus ex machina, and then in this, it kind of inverts that, and all of a sudden the son is sacrificing the father.
Yeah.
Did I get that right?
Yeah. Yeah. Close enough. We'll go with it.
All right.
but it speaks to how this like twisted idea of family is so built into how this business operates, right? The second to last episode ends with Logan declaring they would need a blood sacrifice. And it becomes clear throughout this final episode is this debate about who the blood sacrifice will be. And it has to be family, right? Like this, the decision is made that it has to be either Logan or one of his children, right? That none of the other business associates matter, not even people who have married into the family matter.
Right.
Even Connor, who very generously offers to sacrifice himself and his presidential ambitions, would not be good enough to matter. But it is like this idea of family, however warped and twisted it is, like shapes how this family is perceived on an international level.
So the other thing I was thinking too with Kendall and Greg being dispatched to this press conference is, it's totally Hamlet and Rosencrantz and Guildenstern being sent to England. And the idea, of course, is that Hamlet is not going to survive this trip, but he reverses it. He swaps the letters. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern get executed. Claudius's plan is thwarted, and then Hamlet returns for the final confrontation. So in this case, we get Hamlet/Kendall is putting the blame on Claudius, the father, who we can also think about in terms of Lear. And so Rosencrantz or Greg happens to survive, but he gets co-opted from his original mission, which is to make sure Kendall does this press conference and takes the fall. gets executed in Hamlet's case. But instead, he's got the documents, right? Just like the letter in Shakespeare. And again, as Corey alluded to, like, these documents have been through a wild ride. In the first season, Greg is supposed to shred them, but he saves a few. He creates a jingle, in fact, that he sings while he makes copies of them. And then he shreds the original, but he keeps the copy, or shreds the copy, and but he keeps the original.
And he keeps them in a folder labeled private.
He keeps them in a private folder at his office labeled private, because that's the kind of detective mind he has.
Because and then, he says sometimes the janitorial staff looks through looks through the files, yes. And he wants them to know they can't read that particular file.
And then, so Tom finds this out and, like, has a ceremony in which they are going to burn these files, yep. And he gets distracted just long enough for Greg to
snatch it,
yank some of these documents out. But your connection to Shakespeare is great, and it's a great transition. So we're going to take a break, and we're going to come back and talk about the sexiest of all possible topics, intertextuality.
All right. Welcome back to Technically Pop, where we're talking about Succession. And in particular, we're now going to talk about the very sexy topic of intertextuality.
So... A lot of people pointed out that the basic premise of the show, going back to the first season, has this kind of parallel to King Lear, right? So Lear opens with the old king. He's got three children, three daughters, and he's decided he's going to retire. And he holds this kind of weird competition where they all need to flatter him, and he's going to decide who's going to get what territory. And of course, through the course of the play, he tries to keep his prerogatives as king while having given away most of his power. He eventually learns wisdom through suffering, and I won't spoil the ending for you, but if you haven't read it, you know, it's a good one.
But there's this moment, I alluded to it earlier, there's this brief moment where King Lear has been, for several acts, I'm not exactly sure which act this happens in, but for several acts, King Lear has been selfish, greedy, very Logan-esque. And there's a moment where he's caught in a rainstorm and he offers his coat to someone else. So that's the sort of signal that for once he's able to cultivate and display empathy. And we've not had that moment for Logan yet, and I suspect we won't.
No, Logan keeps his fabulous cable knit cardigans to himself.
It's like that video. Have you seen that video of Trump where he has this enormous golf umbrella and he's like walking with it and Melania is just like stuck in the rain trailing behind him? It's that. It's closer to that than it is to King Lear offering his coat.
Yeah, yeah. Logan is sort of one-third Lear, one-third Trump, one-third Murdoch.
That seems right.
So it is, it's King Lear in its sort of broad strokes and sort of its structure. But I think that Logan is aware of his King Lear-ness to a certain extent in a way that King Lear isn't.
Yes.
And I think that he knows that his position, sort of the power that he holds just by virtue of being the owner or the CEO or the COO of this?
I don't know what the difference
he's
is.
He's the CEO.
Thank you. Yeah. So as being the CEO of Royco?
Waystar Royco.
Which we've never got an explanation as to what Waystar is. Of who Waystar is. I'll just throw that in there.
Because the dirty secret of the show is that he's not actually very good as a business person, right?
Or at least not in 2019.
Right, but even before that, because when Kendall serves as acting CEO while he's out of commission with the stroke, he learns that they are deeply in debt due to this irresponsible taking on of money. Much of the plot of season two is around this acquisition that no one but Logan thinks is a good idea. But there is what he is good at is understanding sort of people's need and willingness to cow to what he wants, right? What he's good at is knowing that that sort of fake affection can be used to his own ends, right? And so he knows that he can cow people to vote his way. There's a planned vote of no confidence. And he's not supposed to be in the room for this legally, and he refuses to leave, right, in season one. Yeah. Because he knows, like, the power of his presence in the room has to change people's votes, right? People who had been plotting this, They had the votes. All they had to do was vote the way they said they were going to. And with him in the room, they couldn't, right? And Roman, most humiliatingly, right, can't even look up from the ground as he cows to what his father demands of him. So it's like, it's a Lear that wants that sort of fake affection because it can be used to his ends in some kind of way.
Yeah, and there's also just interesting parallels of madness and suffering. You get, obviously, in the first season, we've talked about the stroke that Logan has, and in Lear, especially in the third act, he's out on the heath, he's in the rain, as we've mentioned, and he's veering towards madness. And what ends, he comes out of that, he recovers some sense of sanity, but he's a completely chastened person. Whereas Logan, when he recovers his faculties after this stroke, he doubles down on who he was before, right? Mm-hmm. He doesn't show any more affection to his kids. He still is manipulative. He still kind of tortures them emotionally. He still acts as a strong man. He puts people through these weird ceremonies. So there's the boar on the floor moment, right? Where he is forcing people to say whether they agree with him or disagree with his plan. He singles out various members, Tom, Greg, and, you know, he has them act as pigs, as boars, which they were hunting earlier that day.
And hunting is a generous term for what they were doing.
Yes.
It's that kind of rich person hunting where people literally push animals into your line of sight.
Right, and you just shoot at them.
It's essentially a slaughter that they were doing. And then he forces his employees to reenact this.
In a game that the rules of which only he seems to know.
Yes. And they're fighting over table scraps that he controls, right? I mean, it's very much like a reenactment of how he sees his business.
Yeah. And just to bring in a slightly different kind of historical analog, Jesse Armstrong has actually said that he got inspiration from Stalin when they did that scene. So Stalin would hold these dinner parties, much like these kind of closed-door dinner parties where Stalin would drink water and everyone else would be drinking vodka or whatever, booze. And in the scene, Logan is kind of pushing liquor on everyone and demanding that they celebrate and toast. And then basically he would draw out their secrets and then later extort them. So Logan is, he's not just Lear, who's relying on very public forms of flattery. He's also Stalin, who's manipulating his own family and employees.
And I hadn't known that until just this moment, but there's later in the season, there's a character named Rhea. Is it Rhea? So later in the season, there's a character named Rhea who's sort of from the sort of Kennedy-esque liberal light family. Yeah.
She works for the family. She's not.
She's a cousin, I thought.
Is she a cousin?
Okay. I think she's just the CEO of the Pierce Company. Or PGM.
She's clearly aligned with them at the beginning of
She's aligned
She
with
has
them.
Some principles.
Yes. Yeah. And she moves to the Waystar Company. And she and Logan start... It's a sexual relationship? Or is it just hinted to be sexual?
I think he wants it to be sexual. And she is more professional than that.
Okay.
Everyone assumes...
Everyone thinks it is.
That's
correct. I don't
correct.
Know if there's ever on-camera confirmation one way or the other.
I think it's pretty strongly implied that it's not based on Rhea's reaction to Marcia when Marcia,
that's
Logan's
probably right.
current wife, confronts her about it.
Okay.
But there's a scene where right before the night that they either do or don't sleep together, where they're drinking whiskey, and then in the morning it is revealed that Rhea typically does not drink, that she typically doesn't drink. And Logan takes this as a personal affront. He says, you don't drink, but you drank whiskey with me, right? And he's very, very worked up about this. So the tables got turned on him a little bit there. He let his guard down thinking he and Rhea were kind of on the same page, and they weren't, right? Rhea was,
she was more guarded.
Rhea accepted a drink, but I don't think she drank it. Right, mm-hmm. I think is the implication.
Yeah,
and that Logan feels very betrayed.
It's this sort of like jocular drinking culture of like, because we're drinking together, we know that we are aligned and we can trust one another.
And he had thought of it as a collaboration between equals, and all of a sudden he has realized, no, this is what I typically do to my subordinates, which is push alcohol on them and then see what happens. she has done that to me now.
Yeah, one of the interesting things about that season is seeing how the relationship between Logan and Rhea blooms and then frays, and she kind of maintains a moral compass that once she really realizes how shady he is, she's not really comfortable. But she goes to great lengths to sort of get in his good graces, get in line to be the CEO.
She convinces herself that he's kind. Yeah. She takes Shiv to lunch and is like, your father's so kind. And Shiv is like, if you say so, right?
She's trying to convince herself of that from their first meeting, which begins like through a series of cloak and dagger that they all must just, because it can't be known publicly that she came to meet with them. And there are all these moments where Logan essentially tells her that she can't trust him. And yet she's like convincing herself that she can in this interesting way.
Yeah. It's kind of like Shiv trying to talk herself into, or out of, excuse me, working for the Bernie Sanders character. Shiv, for part of the season, is working for a senator inspired by Bernie Sanders.
And to this point, her job was to work with Democratic candidates. She's like the black sheep of the family in that she is progressive.
And she had been working for like a Hillary Clinton type character. She gets hired away to work for this like Democratic socialist, Gil Evis, right?
Yes.
Gil Evis. And
Who's
running for president. Who's from Brooklyn, who looks like Bernie Sanders. And the only way she can get out of it, she can't just quit. She can't just say, I don't want to do this anymore. I want to go work for Waystar Royco. She has to convince herself that he is morally compromised so that she feels okay about quitting.
And she, like, concocts this situation where he will be morally compromised, right?
Yes.
In terms of his relationship to the Fox News stand-in, the Waystar Royco News Network, which is called
ATN.
Thank you, ATN. Do we know what that stands for?
American Television Network.
Okay, that sounds right. So she essentially like sets up this compromise between him and ATN to like reach a stalemate. They're having this like war of the words, and through this action, she convinces herself that even this seemingly pure figure can be compromised, can be corrupted, and therefore nothing matters, and it's okay if she goes to her family business, which is what she wants to do.
But she can't admit to herself that's what she wants to do.
Which is kind of a common theme for her.
Yeah, that's maybe a good... I think we were going to try to talk about these authors chronologically, but screw it. That's a great lead-in to Sally Rooney.
Yeah.
So if you don't know who Sally Rooney is, she's a 28-year-old Irish writer. She's come out with two novels very recently, both of which have been very critically acclaimed. And the connection to Succession is that in the finale, Shiv is reading Conversations with Friends, which is one of Sally Rooney's novels. And I was laughing about this because I work on contemporary Irish literature. So I thought, oh, great. I'm so glad that Shiv is reading Sally Rooney. But the thing that made me think about it, I think, a little bit more was I saw this Twitter status from Matt Zetlin, who writes, apparently Shiv was reading a Sally Rooney show on the HBO series Succession. The degree to which you people love being blatantly and disrespectfully pandered to should be examined by a mental health professional. which is great because, yes, Sally Rooney is being read by the exact people who are watching this HBO prestige drama. But I thought about it a little more. Have either of you read any Sally Rooney?
I have not.
I just read like one chapter, like an excerpt.
Okay. Yeah. So Sally Rooney is a very avowed Marxist. Her protagonists are very avowed Marxists. And she famously utilizes a lot of free indirect discourse. So the more I thought about it, the more I don't know that this is straight up pandering. I am going to push back against that a little bit, as funny as that tweet might be. Because I think Sally Rooney is an excellent stand-in for who Shiv thinks she is and this narrative Shiv has constructed about herself. I think Shiv thinks she's in control of every situation and that everything that's happening around her is narrated through her own subjectivity. I think that that is simultaneously true with the seemingly contradictory theory Shiv seems to hold about herself, which is that she is a Marxist. Neither of these things are true, but Shiv has managed to hold two ideas in her head at once, which are she is an individual change agent who controls everything based on her own narrative, and Shiv is a woman of the people, also, which is blatantly untrue as she is working for the Fox News thing. And that tension, I think, is inherent in the way Shiv perceives herself. And I think, I don't think there's any self-awareness there where Shiv would, very akin to Logan, be able to admit to herself that that is not true.
This raises another point about these references, which is that there's sort of two kinds of references and allusions happening in the show. There's like the stuff that we see as viewers, like, oh, this looks a lot like King Lear, right? Oh, these characters seem like Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. And then there are the sort of textual references that exist in the universe.
Yes.
Right? Like she's reading Rooney. There's a great scene that Josh dug up recently where Greg and Tom are arguing over whether it's okay to work for ATM.
ATN? It's like kind of against my principles.
Your principles? Greg, don't be an asshole. You don't have principles.
Dude, ATN is a very toxic element in the culture.
Seriously, okay, name me one principle that you have.
I don't know, like I'm against racism.
Bullshit, I'm against racism. Everybody's against racism. What else?
Like, don't lie.
Fuck off.
Like, if you're the news.
Fuck
like
off. Hey, that's your principle?
Yeah, dude.
Greg, this is not fucking Charles Dickens' world, okay? You don't go around talking about principles. We're all trying to do the right thing. Of course we are. But come on, man.
Famously principled people of a Dickens novel.
Yes. Yeah, right. And there's this other character that we haven't mentioned, Frank, who has an English degree, right?
And is always quoting poetry.
Is just always quoting poetry. There's this great moment where he refers to Rhea as our Coriolanus, and Logan says, why don't you take your library card and fuck off? But there's an earlier moment where they had fired Frank in season one because Roman doesn't like Frank, essentially. But then they need Frank.
Right, and he's part of Kendall's coup as well.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. And they need Frank back for some reason. And they coax
the Pierces. He's in with the Pierces.
That's right.
That's right. Yeah.
Thank you for that.
Because he has an English degree. Because so, of course.
Because he's a human being.
So, of course.
Like the rest of them.
He's going to appeal most to these people who fancy themselves the Kennedys.
Who also quote a bunch of poetry.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. And they coax him back in part with a watch that has a quote from Tennyson's Ulysses on the back, right? But this poem, Ulysses, is a dramatic monologue from the perspective of Ulysses as he's leaving on like one last voyage. And it's like partially this celebration of like an ambition that outstrips ability, like this like raging against the dying of the light. But it's also this like he leaves the day-to-day work of ruling his kingdom to his wife, who he insults multiple times, and his son. So it's also this, it's a very Logan kind of figure where he's going off with his boys on one last fun voyage and his aged wife, and that's Tennyson's word, not mine, and his son get to stay behind. So there's this interesting thing where these literary references are doing work within the universe, right? You all mentioned the Pierces, who like demand Shakespearean quotations at dinner.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, they also quote Whitman, right? When they go out to look at the stars.
That's right.
Yes.
That's
yes. Right. One of the members is working on his second PhD.
Is it Africana studies?
Africana studies, and I think astronomy, right? Like completely unrelated fields.
Is that what it is? And I Shiv's insult to him is, oh, once you finish the second one, you can know things that it takes other people 12 seconds to look up on Wikipedia, and it cuts me to my core.
Yes.
Too real.
Also a reminder that I guess if you are extraordinarily wealthy, you can just pay your way to a PhD, right? Yeah.
And just get as many as you want.
And just get as many as you want.
Just go back for another 5 years.
The stakes are very low.
But I think what's interesting there, the contrast between the Roys and the Pierces, right, on this issue of literature and reading, and Frank is this kind of weird mediator between them. So Shiv is reading Sally Rooney, but she's really dismissive of this academic. Mm-hmm. Tom is familiar enough, educated enough with Dickens, and perhaps with another story novel that we'll get to in a second with The Great Gatsby, but he's educated enough to drop this Dickens reference to tell Greg, look, you don't need to have these earnest moral principles. You just need to put your career first and not worry. You know, of course we're not racist. Like, this is just the news. This is just our career. So they have these markers of class status, right? They're educated. They're familiar with the literary world. But it just doesn't mean anything to them, really. It isn't really sincere. And same thing with Logan giving Frank that watch. Like, Logan might in some ways sympathize with Tennyson's Ulysses if he took any time to read it, but he just doesn't care. But Frank, oh my gosh, this thing knocks the socks off Frank. Like, because he and the Pierces, they have this genuine affection for the liberal arts and humanities and human knowledge. And the Roy is like, they don't understand knowledge, really. They don't value knowledge.
It's tools. It's tools to it's be wielded, right? Yeah, yeah, and like Tennyson is useful in that moment.
Because it manipulates Frank.
Yes, yeah. but you're right. No, I don't think that Logan has ever identified himself in Ulysses.
But not to be, you know, grim and knock on what the three of us have decided to do for our lives. But does it make any difference? Because yes, the Pierces may understand the humanities and they may quote Shakespeare and they may get their PhDs at Columbia, but they're also not good people, and they're also not doing, they also are not having good effects on the American political landscape.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think it's tools for the Pierces too, but just in a different way.
That's fair.
Right? There's a scene where they're at the Pierces, one of the homes owned by the Pierces, and there's like Latin on the wall, right? Roman is trying to read it. I mean,
Roman can't read their family crest.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a tool for them too. It's just a tool that's wielded differently.
Yes.
I think. Yeah.
Yeah. They own the MSNBC version of this, of the cable news universe.
Right, but their principles won't necessarily preclude them from accepting a buyout from the Roys if the money is right.
Right.
And so, you know, they basically need plausible deniability that there will be independence in the two newsrooms.
Yes.
Though, to be fair, I mean, they do blow up the deal because Logan doesn't, you know, he doesn't quite follow what they wanted to do. They learn a little more about him. It's a little too unsavory. What they needed, yeah, you're right. They need a plausible deniability. And once they don't have that and they really realize, yeah, this guy's kind of a scumbag, you know, you got my hackles up. I couldn't just have peace of mind that I was giving my company to an honest broker.
It's kind of like never Trumpers who object to Trump, right? Mm-hmm. They don't actually have a problem with Trump's policies. They have a problem with his vulgarity. Right.
Yeah, and what blows the deal up ultimately is the Cruz scandal comes out.
Yeah.
Right? And it's like, we have to handle the fallout from this Cruz scandal in a way that makes the Pierces happy. Right. And it seems very clear that had that stayed, like, it's like hours, right? Like, they're like ready to sign that deal.
Right.
And there's like this tense scene over breakfast, maybe, where like they're all looking at their phone, hoping that it doesn't come out yet. Mm-hmm. But it's another thing that the Roys mismanage, right? Because their strategy for how to delay this story backfires, right? They decide to fight this story full strength. And it's Kendall's idea to fight it, and then instead it just comes out, right?
Yes.
Whereas had they, like, played ball with the reporters, like, oh, yeah, they could have delayed that story for a couple of weeks, or at least a couple of days.
Potentially.
Which could have gotten the deal through in the meanwhile. But it's another example of the Roys maybe not being great business people.
And being fish out of water, right? Yeah. Which, I mean, for all of Logan's blustering about his upbringing that actually wasn't so traumatic, there is a sense that they've learned how to belong in this New York media landscape, but they're not naturals at it in the way the Pierces are with their family crest and their years of liberal arts education and their Columbia PhDs. There's always a sense the Roys are not, they're the, if we want to go back to the Trump analogy, like they're the Queens people trying to blend in Manhattan, right? Which,
And Shiv, who is the best at aping, in part because she lies to herself, she's the one that the Pierces do have their faith in.
Yes.
Until it finally the deal becomes broken, right? But Shiv is part of the reason they want Logan to name Shiv the successor is that that will calm the Pierces' anxieties.
Right.
Because she looks the part. She acts the part better than her siblings. Although the minute Roman tries to have an adult conversation with her on that boat, she's right there with Kendall mocking him.
Right. Right.
Being a child again.
Yep. And speaking of
Children.
Fish out of water.
Fish out of water in New York. Yeah.
A fish out of water in New York City. I want to put forward my most cherished close reading of this show and see if you guys agree with me, which is that I am not an Americanist, but even I know that when people are from St. Paul, Minnesota, and they are in New York trying to make it in the big leagues, that's not a casual reference you drop in. And Tom Wamsgans is a St. Paul, Minnesota boy whose mother is one of the most respected lawyers in the Twin Cities, as he proudly informs Shiv as they're planning for their wedding. And he's trying to make it in the big leagues in New York City, and he's just out of his depth. And that's not something you drop in lightly. Mm-hmm. Tom Wamsgans is a very lightly masked Nick Carraway character, right? Like, he's the one who's getting carried away in all this. Mm-hmm. He's the one who's been transplanted, and he's the one who... It's never quite right, right?
Yeah, and I'm also not an Americanist, but I have spent enough time in Minnesota to know that, yes, no fictional character is accidentally from St. Paul. Minneapolis, maybe, not St. Paul. But I feel like just like your point about Logan is Lear before he gives his coat to anyone, right? Tom is like... Chapter 4 Nick Carraway,
yes.
Right? Like he's still enjoying the parties, right? He's yes. still, like, enjoying hanging out with the female tennis pros and things like that, right? It's not the... It's... To whatever extent, like, Nick Carraway figures out what's going on, Tom
Which is none.
Yeah, fair.
He never does, right? He opens the book by saying, like, I am really cognizant of privilege, and then just goes on. I don't have the exact quote at the ready, and then just goes on through the entire book to demonstrate how obtuse he is, right?
Yeah, yeah. Although he levels criticisms against parts of this culture in a way that Tom doesn't, right? I mean, there's a scene where Tom introduces Greg to being rich, and like that's what he says, right? And they go to this very fancy dinner and they eat ortolan.
Oh, Jesus. What now?
Ortolan.
What's ortolan?
It is a deep-fried songbird. You eat it whole.
Oh my god.
This is like a rare privilege, and it's also kind of illegal.
Oh, I have it.
For the head, the exact purpose is debated. Some say it's to mask the shame, others to heighten the pleasure.
Oh my god. I have so got so good. Did you eat it yet, Greg?
Not yet, no.
Eat it, Greg.
Mm-hmm. It's a rather unique flavor.
Yeah, that's the gamey, brainy hit, my friend. Oh. Can we have some more wine, please?
You trying to seduce me, Tom?
Yes, I am. Yes, I am, Greg.
He loves being rich.
He loves it so much.
To the point that even when he knows that his marriage is not working, and even to the point that the scene where Shiv is reading Sally Rooney, that scene ends with Tom telling her that he is not happy. And part of it is this fish out of water thing where he thinks he's going into this traditional monogamous marriage. And she does not, right? She just kind of has this expectation of an open marriage.
Which she drops on their wedding night.
Which she reveals to him on their wedding night. Although there are hints along the way that Tom is oblivious to.
That's probably fair.
Including at his bachelor party, where he keeps calling to, like, check if what he wants to do is okay with her. And at no point is she concerned.
Right.
But Tom says this devastating thing to her, which is, I think that the sadness I feel when I'm with you is worse than the sadness I would feel without you. But then the conversation immediately turns back to how to save his position in the company, right? It goes back to, but how do I stay in the family? And so even when he recognizes that the family is bad for him, he can't do anything but try to stay in, however misguided his efforts to stay in.
He can't get on the train and go back to St. Paul, like Nick Carraway does, right?
Right. Yeah, that's maybe what I was getting at.
Yeah.
He also, yeah, it's really interesting. I love this parallel. I think Tom, so he has a little bit of what Gatsby feels toward Daisy, right, is what he feels towards Shiv in the sense that he idealizes her.
Mm-hmm.
He has the Nick, like, trying to blend in this new foreign culture, this upward striving, but he's just so oblivious to the rules of the game. Mm-hmm. At one point, when Shiv is kind of telling him that she is going to be the next CEO, or so she thinks, or so she plans, in complete earnestness, he says to her, "Oh, I thought we were planning that for me. Like, I thought the plan was for me to be the CEO." Like, he doesn't even understand that he will never run this company, that there is a limit to what he can achieve, that, yes, he will get shuttled around to run different divisions. You know, first he's at parks, then he's at cruises. But he will never ascend to the highest levels, and he's really only there because of nepotism. And he just has this earnest, Midwestern, meritocratic, like, if I just work hard and work my connections and suck up to Logan and marry Shiv, if I do all these things, I'm going to have this perfect life. I'm going to be rich. I'm going to be successful. I'm going to be running this company one day, right? I'm the son-in-law that's going to take over. And he just doesn't quite realize that he's Guildenstern, right? He's a secondary player. He's a courier. He's not one of these central characters, which becomes painfully evident, as we've alluded to earlier, in that finale, where they're deciding who the blood sacrifice is going to be. And a bunch of them want to blame Tom because he's an easy target. And even Shiv is like, oh, it should be Tom.
And legally, he bears the most responsibility for this particular crisis. He was involved in an illegal cover-up of this particular series of corporate malfeasance.
Exactly. But at the end of the day, he's just not a big enough fish. And so even his anger at Shiv not defending him staunchly enough, which she then behind the scenes goes to her father and is like, it can't be Tom, like, you know, and she's pushing for it to be Kendall. Even that, it's misplaced. It was never going to be him. He's never important enough to even save the company through his destruction, mm-hmm. the way that Kendall, the firstborn son, is.
Right.
Yeah, and this is part of that conversation, right? And so I think part of what Tom is insulted by is that everyone would consider him as a sacrifice, but also that he wouldn't be a big enough sacrifice, right? That it and it becomes, it's almost like listening to people discuss like a sports trade, where it's like, well, Tom, but then we'd also have to throw in Greg
Sprinkles.
Greg Sprinkles and maybe Frank. Like, it becomes this like which pieces.
How many draft picks?
Yeah, like how many minor figures will match one blood sacrifice? And the answer is there aren't enough, right? Yeah. The answer is it has to be blood, at least as far as the Roy, the like decision making structure decides, right?
Yes. Because it's the most Catholic thing I've ever seen in my entire life. So there has to be a blood sacrifice, right?
Say more.
Oh. I guess we don't know that much about Logan's upbringing, right? We know he grew up in Dundee.
Immigrated to
Canada. Has a younger brother. So we don't know all that much about.
There's some unknown tragedy with their sister.
That's right. I forgot about that.
I don't know the details of that exactly.
But I honestly think we can very fairly assume there's a huge strain of Catholicism running throughout this family. If nothing else, right, the daughter's name is Siobhan. Mm-hmm. And this love of, like, this, even this backstory he has constructed for himself is based on pain, right? Mm-hmm. And what is more Catholic than getting pleasure through suffering? Very little. there's this, like, deep sense of hierarchy, right? And then, of course, there's the need for a blood sacrifice. Nothing else will do. And, of course, that is, again, one of the most Catholic things I've ever heard of. These people are just, you know, they won't even go to a therapist. They're definitely not going to go to a priest, but they, mm-hmm. you know.
Although he very, and I think that's right. Although it's interesting because he thinks he's sacrificing his son, right? Like, which is this very biblical sacrifice. But the story he tells Kendall about why he has to sacrifice Kendall is not biblical. Right.
I don't remember what he says.
The Incas.
He tells the story about traveling with Marcia and hearing the story about the Incans
why they would sacrifice their children.
Their children, and correct me if I get this wrong. He says how barbaric, and Marcia says, "What what do you love enough that killing it could bring the sun back, right?
Yeah.
S-U-N, although the pun is obviously there.
Right.
And it's like, this would be one moment where you would think someone like Logan would like bring up the Christian sacrifice, right?
Yeah.
And it's something, and now that you've said this, like, has there been a, where's the wedding?
It's, are they in a church for the wedding? Scotland.
No, I mean, does the ceremony happen in,
I don't think we ever see the ceremony. We just see the reception, right?
Is there ever a church on screen in this show?
There's the funeral for Mo.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. There's the Mo's funeral, which only Connor goes to, right?
Correct.
Connor. Correct, yeah.
Yeah. It's just, it seems like an absence that makes the presence. Like, now that you mention this, I, like, can't stop thinking about how it's just there but not mentioned at all.
Yes, it's very much a specter is haunting them.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
The line about the Incas is fascinating. The whole thing of what Logan intends Kendall to take from it, I kind of interpret it as it's another act of manipulation. He's given him this narrative, and Kendall, I think rightfully, maybe even heroically, chooses to renounce. Mm-hmm. He snaps out of this coma of guilt that he's been in, and he decides to win his dad's respect the only way possible, right? By, as Roman says, killing him. You got to go after him. And it's this perverse thing with Logan and Kendall where the whole first season is Kendall, he wants to make the company better. He wants to modernize it. He wants to do these innovations. He wants to succeed his father. And Logan won't give up the throne. You get two attempts by Kendall, two failed attempts to take it by force. And Logan proves like he's still the alpha, right? And then in the second season, you get Kendall completely under Logan's sway because of this guilt he's carrying, because of this guy whose death he's responsible for and he feels acutely responsible for. Mm-hmm. And then by the end, Logan thinks that he can just sort of say, you need to go do this. And Kendall, all he wants in that moment is some affirmation that he could have taken over.
Right.
That he would, that he was good enough, but circumstances intervened, basically. So right. He asked his dad, look, do you think I could have done this? And all Logan has to say is, you know what? You could have. You would have been a great CEO. I'm sorry it didn't work out that way. We need you to take the fall. But you know what, son? You would have been great. And he can't bring him to say that. He just says, I don't know if you're a killer. You got to be a killer. Maybe you don't nowadays, but I don't know if you're a killer. And it's unstated, but it seems clear that basically that is what gives Kendall the kind of chutzpah to say, I'm more of a killer than you think. I'm going to turn this around on you. Mm-hmm. He finds out that Greg has these documents. And we get that last shot of the season with this mysterious, like, grin, smirk, whatever is on Logan's face. And there's a lot of speculation, like, is he proud of Kendall? Is he angry? Why is he so reserved? You know, they see this happening live on TV. Roman's flipping out a little bit. Shiv is very shocked. And Logan just has this kind of half smile on his face.
Right.
There's a conspiracy theory on the internet that this all happened according to Logan's plan. Do you all buy that?
Maybe.
No. For now, no. I could be proven wrong. I'll say no.
I'm with you. I think that if Logan was that good at manipulating people, they wouldn't be in the situation that they are.
There was a simpler solution.
Like the levels that it would have taken. I think that look is...
This is the Trump wanted us to impeach him
kind of argument. Yes, yes. This is Logan Roy playing 4D chess. Yes. Okay, so when we come back, we're going to talk about what this show is and why we like it. Okay, so welcome back. We're back for our third and final segment on what has become a long conversation about Succession. And I think we want to wrap up by just kind of talking about what this show is. It's been surprisingly hard to get a hold on this. Some of the genres that I've seen thrown around in think pieces are comedy, satire, obviously, but also body horror. Soap opera, Shakespeare, which we've talked about a little bit. And then also, why do we like it so much? And what does it mean that we, and I both mean us, the three of us, and also just like culturally, why has this show suddenly taken off the way that it has in the last couple of years? So y'all can jump in wherever you see fit.
I will, cards on the table. I'm far less interested in the what is this show question than I am in the question of why we like it. Because I don't know why I like this show. My husband and I watched it together, and he was like, why do I like this? And I said, because it's well written. And he said, is it though? And I think that's a fair question. I don't know why I like this show so much. But as Corey pointed out, like, we could talk about this for 12 hours. There is something about this that I am fascinated by. And that's probably part and parcel of the question of what is this? What is the genre? But I don't know how to answer. I don't know how to answer that question.
I think a couple things come to mind for me. I think it is well written. I think it's exceptionally well written. When you think about, like, a litmus test for a lot of, you know, good TV writing, does every character have an arc? Yes. Is there zingy dialogue that's funny and memorable? Absolutely. A lot of great burns, great insults. Are the performances strong? Of course, we have that. But I think the thing that's compelling to me is it manages to, and this is part of the genre question, I think, for me, of why I like it, it manages to straddle this weird boundary between the high drama, these Shakespearean notes, the mundane. Like, in the scene where they're in the panic room, there's been a shooting at ATN. It turns out, perhaps appropriately, to have been a suicide, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Greg and Tom end up in the second-rate panic room, whereas Logan and Shiv and Kendall and Rhea Jarrell are conducting business in the snazzy, you know, high-level panic room. And
just to be clear, the secondary panic room is just a room.
It's just a room.
It's like a supply closet.
It is a room that a security guard has declared as a panic room.
And Greg is freaking out because he's like, is gas going to come in from under the door, right? So part of what's great about the show is, in this show that's so intense and serious and allegedly this high Shakespearean drama, which it is, you get a scene where Tom starts flinging water bottles of water that are just like stacked in this room at Greg.
Because it's a supply closet.
Because it's just a room, yeah. You get this incredible physical comedy out of nowhere, and it's so compelling. And you have moments like that all throughout the show where there's, much like Shakespeare, there's the high and the low. There's different classes of people, at least within the strata of the uber wealthy, right? Greg is essentially, he starts out at the very bottom. He's just working as a mascot at one of the Roy theme parks. And then
vomits through his eyeballs.
Yeah. Vomiting through his costume. Right. Yeah.
So you get the low, you get Logan, the sort of Lear figure. You get people in the middle. You get all kinds of different types of people within this world. So I do think it's well written. I do think the performances are great. And I think it's able to take the most compelling parts of a number of genres, right? So there are satirical elements, there's tragic elements, there's physical comedy, there's witty dialogue. It just does so much. And somehow it nails it. It never, to me, it's always compelling. It never feels like a Frankenstein's monster, like, why are these things stitched together? It has an organic quality to it, like maybe it's sui generis for 2019 television, but it is of a piece with itself. The whatever tone that it is, it kind of maintains.
It has throughout. A consistent tone, yeah. Even if we can't articulate what that tone is.
Yeah, well, and I agree with you about the writing and specifically the insults. So I know Molly and I share a love for the recently ended HBO show Veep. I don't know.
Oh, it's the best. It's so best. Good. Yeah.
And Veep, for a very long time, had the best insults on television. And now Succession does, but they're good in a different way. Like, the insults in Veep are linguistically inventive, but surface level. It's like about what people look like, or just like insults about how unintelligent a person is.
Their body parts.
Body parts, yes, but like endlessly inventive linguistically. In Succession, they're very succinct and straightforward, but they're cutting to like the very bottom of these people's characters.
Identity, yes. Right? Personality.
And they are horrifying in that way, which also makes it very entertaining to watch, I think. But I asked both of these questions, and I agree with you, Molly. I think why do we like it is a more interesting question than what is this show? But the question that keeps getting asked on the internet, which is all that matters today, is what is this show? But I think those questions are related. Because I think what the show is a soap opera, right? Yeah. It's powerful people competing for more power. Their arcs have them like shift from hero to villain very quickly, right? Like we began today by talking about Roman, who for the first 15 or 16 episodes of the show was like the screw up, right? The one who would always undercut things with a joke, but now is the one showing development, right? Who's now the most emotionally mature member of the family all of a sudden. And I think there are elements of all of these other things here, but I think that in highlighting, you know, Shakespeare or elements of body horror or like classical elements of satire or something, we're kind of like working through our own anxieties about loving a soap opera. But I think maybe a soap opera is what we want right now.
let me ask you this in terms of what a soap opera is, or in what way this is a glorified soap opera. Can characters change in a soap opera? Because, and if so, in what ways? What are the constraints on that? Because at least with Roman, as you just mentioned,
yeah,
we see this with Kendall, with some of the other characters, with Greg, you know, Greg develops a taste for champagne, which he absolutely does not have in the pilot episode.
It's not my favorite, but I'll drink
but
it.
But I'll drink it. We see, I mean, it's really patient, careful character development. I don't know if you're allowed to do that with a soap opera. That doesn't discount that it doesn't have those elements.
Yeah.
With the power struggle, shifting relationships.
I don't know that much about soap operas, but my instinct is, I mean, these things run for 40, 50 years, right? Characters have to be able to change.
Yeah, and it's maybe a little more rubber band, like first I was a hero and now I'm a heel, or vice versa.
Right.
But I think, like, it is a very soap opera thing for someone like Roman, who is introduced in the pilot, and I very briefly thought, oh, he's the audience's way in because he calls bullshit on everything. But then the second or third scene he's in, he does something so monstrous, right? He humiliates that child in the baseball game that it's like, oh, no, this person is garbage.
He's the impish.
Oh, that is the best scene, though. It's so good right out the gate.
It's a very good scene, and I'm gonna argue against myself here about my this is a soap opera, because I've been thinking about this scene since I first watched it, and for a very long time, until very recently, I thought that the point of that scene was that Roman is a monster, but it's actually that they're all monsters, because his family could have let that kid. So the scene, if you don't remember. They need to have someone else needs to bat that isn't in the family in this family baseball game. It doesn't matter why. And they get this child of employees of the family to come take a bat. Roman is on base. The game is on the line, and he offers this child, like 10, 12, maybe years old. They offer, Roman says, I will give you $1 million if you hit a home run and win the game for us, and like writes the check out for him, like pauses the game to write this check out. The kid like has a fantastic hit and he's rounding third, and the family could have just let him score.
Right. What's $1 million?
Right. They could, well, what's $1 million that belonged to Roman?
Also that.
Right?
Yeah.
And instead they choose to win the game and humiliate this poor kid. And then there's this like,
for whom $1 million
would have changed their lives, yes. Right? And you see in the background, like, these, like, unnamed lawyers, like, go over and clearly get this family to sign a series of Steel Club NDAs. Yeah. But it's, so, the first time I watched that scene, I thought, oh, Roman is a monster. But they all participated in this.
Yes.
Even, at, like, Logan, like, tries to say something kind to the boy, but doesn't offer to give him the money or anything.
And
right?
What good is a kind word when you could have had $1 million?
Exactly. Yeah. I got us away from what we were talking about.
Soap operas.
So Roman's not our way in.
No, yeah. So, but this, there's something about, I mean, characters change and other things, but this idea that Roman can go from this horrifying figure to now the most emotionally mature member of the Roy family.
But I think he'll snap back, man.
Yeah, well.
I mean, I think every season has been about a different child, right? So season one was Kendall. Season two was Shiv. We're all set up for season three to be Roman's season. Mm-hmm. And I think he'll crack under pressure. I think he'll snap right back to being a heel. Unless we come out of nowhere and Connor gets a section or a season. I know that I see that happening.
I cannot wait for Connor's season four.
So the if you guys like The Watch, shout out to them, the podcast The Watch. They made the argument slightly against the idea of the seasons for the different siblings to the point of they argued that this season, the second season, feels like the second act in a three-act play, and that this current battle for succession will probably conclude in the third season. That doesn't mean the show will conclude, but that kind of the terrain would have to shift. Now, that could still line up with it focusing on Roman. If Kendall is back being outside of the company and Shiv isn't officially in the company, at least for the short term when the third season starts, presumably Roman is kind of the main Roy sibling who's helping run the company. But I think the thing with, again, even just the thing with the way the characters are developed, I think the thing about a soap opera is the characters are pretty static even as they undergo these dramatic reversals.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why there's so many twins and people coming in and out of comas and people dying and faking their deaths and coming back. Because no one actually changes. There just has to be that person needs to go away and return or get displaced and return. But everyone has to have the kind of stable, static essence. Like, this person is the betraying one. This person is a loyal one. Whatever, whatever. I think the part of this show that taps into the appealing thing about a soap opera is the power struggle, right? Mm-hmm. It's the power struggle, and it's these complicated, knotty relationships where this show makes us talk about the minutiae of, like, well, when Kendall said this thing to Shiv, and it sounds much like a soap opera, but I think it does manage to transcend that. Maybe it's just a question of the craft that goes into it, the seriousness of the performances. We've hardly talked about Connor, of course, who deserves his fourth season, but Connor, Alan Ruck of Ferris Bueller fame, is giving this, like, incredible performance as, like, a secondary character who is, you know, he's got this vanity presidential campaign. Just the care with which they choose the weird details about his ranch and about the woman that he's paying to be in a relationship with him and her play that's called, like, Sands or something, and they have to import actual sand.
But it's the wrong kind of sand.
It's
the wrong kind of
sand. It's construction sand. Can you believe it? it's so gauche. Yeah.
And he, you know, the whole way through the show, like, Connor's trying to be a neutral party among the other siblings, and he's always posturing, and he's always, you know, got some weird conspiracy theory. And just the level of detail that goes into...
He believes in a flat tax.
Yeah, of course he does. Of course he does. He wants to keep as much of that change as possible. He's got to humiliate himself and go to Logan because he's low on cash because he's...
Because of this play!
Because of the play and because he's bought what turns out to be not Napoleon's dried penis, but a fake that his eye for antiquity is maybe not as good as he thought. But just those details are so precisely chosen. He's so idiosyncratic. And Alan Ruck is, like, giving this great performance of a guy... It's really weird, but in Ferris Bueller, he plays Cameron, now he plays Connor, and in Ferris Bueller, he's a guy who's depressed, although the film doesn't use that language, but it's obvious. And although we never see his father on screen, he's always trying to get his father's love and approval, and of course, he transcends that by the end of the movie by destroying his father's most prized possession of the Ferrari. And then in this show, he's basically in the same boat. He's trying to get Logan's love and approval just like all the kids are. He's in this perpetual state of childhood where, you know, they're in the car and he's asking Logan to tell them a story. All these details.
But he says it as, tell us a story, Pop.
Yeah,
Pop.
Exactly.
Yes.
All of these things. Now, maybe we can find a soap opera that has that diligence with a secondary or tertiary character. But I think that's what makes the show good is that they're not phoning anything in, right? Everything is very carefully chosen, curated. Every character has an arc. Everything is planned. Or at least it makes us feel that everything's orchestrated.
Yeah, and I agree with all of that. I think the distinction that I would make is that it might be a very high quality soap opera.
Sure.
But it's like shoddy construction is not a genre trait of the soap opera, right? There are many soap operas that are shoddily constructed. and I don't know that that's quite the same thing, but I love that reading of Connor as Cameron. And my favorite Connor moment is a silent one where he's in the background of the hearing, fist pumping
right.
for yes.
every great Kendall dig at the liberal biased media.
Which then the con heads turn into a meme.
Here's an existential question about the con heads. Are the con heads making fun of Connor and Connor doesn't realize it? Or do they unironically like him and meme him?
I read them a little bit like the Yang Gang. So some okay. of them are sincere and a lot of them are ironic leftists.
I think that's right.
Yeah.
Are there ironic leftists in the Yang Gang?
Yes.
Oh, that's weirdly comforting. Any other last thoughts, or maybe should we do season 3 predictions? Or
let's do season 3 predictions.
Okay.
I said that so confidently, but
all
I
right,
really
Nostradamus.
Yeah, I know. Right, I really only have one, which is something we didn't quite talk about, but you know, Roman is named Roman, we think, but Logan often refers to him as Romulus, who is the brother who kills his other brother so he can take over the city of Rome, and I think season 3 is going to be about Romulus being groomed to kill Kendall and take over the company.
Oh, interesting. I could see that as a plot structure for sure. I have no concrete predictions. This show has done a great job, I think, in... I have no idea what's going to happen. Kendall and Greg are sort of allied in this position. We have this biographer out there, right? So,
oh yeah,
I forgot about the biographer.
This woman is writing a biography of Logan that he's tried to shut down. Greg has a hilarious pre-meeting with her that she turns into a meeting, much to his chagrin, and he bails because he doesn't want to be on the record about anything. Connor, just another quick thing about Connor. His quote to her that he keeps saying is that from a young age, Connor Roy was interested in politics, right? He's trying to take a hand in shaping his story there in his presidential run. But that has to come back. There has to be more flack for Tom at ATN. I just have questions like, what's going to happen with Tom and Shiv? Are they going to stay together? Is Kendall going to go back to helping Sandy and Stewie in some way? Is he just going to be on his own? What are Jerry and Roman going to do? Are they going to kind of cement this weird professional sexual mother-son surrogate bond?
Are they going to get married in Germany and eat each other? Or what is it that he says?
Yeah. The with the bridge troll and the, what is his metaphor for their team up? Yes. I had forgotten. So we've got Chekhov's drug addict, we've got Chekhov's helicopter, and now we have
Chekhov's biographer.
Unlicensed biography. So my prediction for season 3 is actually evidence for your prediction for season 3, which is we know that when Kendall goes against the company, Logan does not hesitate to wield personal information about Kendall in the media against him. And Logan knows something that could be very damaging to Kendall, which is that Kendall committed manslaughter.
As does Marsha.
As true. Does Marsha.
And Marsha's son.
And Marsha's son, who
we've not seen since that.
Who we know very little about, but pops up every now and then and is up to something, and I cannot wait to know what.
I think his official thing is like running animation in Europe or something. Yes. Like he has a gig with the company.
So he shows up to Thanksgiving dinner and there's this hilarious scene where they're saying what they're thankful for.
Yeah, Tom's idea, of course.
And he's in my family, because Tom thinks that families are real.
Because he's an earnest Midwesterner.
Silly Tom. The son says, I'm thankful to have been named head of European animation. And no one in the room knew that except Logan, Marsha, and him.
Right.
And someone else says, I'm thankful that we were told that.
Roman, I think.
Yeah, it's a very Roman thing. So that's probably who it was. And so that's his official job. But there's more so going on there.
Chekhov's stepson.
And Chekhov's, yeah. Chekhov's and Marcia. Absent wife, who's been missing for... A
couple episodes.
We've seen a lot of shots of an empty side of Logan's bed.
We also see her get drunk and threaten to spill some secrets. What does she say? If you had lived one day in my shoes?
Or, yeah.
We could talk I could, for days.
It would and, take me a year to tell you my life story yeah. or something like that.
Yes, yes. There's so much going on there, and I feel like that's got to be a direction we're going to go at some point, too.
And the last prediction I think I would like to make is that one of two things can happen with Greg. He is either going to take over this company, or he is going to bottom out and go back to vomiting through his vomiting through his mascot suit at theme parks.
Or both.
There's no
one middle, after the other.
There is no middle ground for Greg.
I think that's right. No, I think that's right. He is either the, like, it's either the comic ending that he runs it all, that he wins the game of Succession.
Like Jonah or, Ryan being president. Yes, in Yes.
Yeah, yeah. yeah he, yes, you're right. He's Jonah Ryan. That's perfect.
But he's given up the $250,000. He's given up $250 million, which would make him the poorest rich man in the world.
He's given up his inheritance.
The middle road is no longer open to Greg.
I will make the point that he is slightly better than Jonah Ryan because he does have principles such as racism is bad and Nazis are bad. And
they're Jonah very Ryan, sophisticated.
Jonah Ryan does not have those principles.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you all for listening to us go on about Succession for an hour and a half. We could go longer, but we'll end it there, I think.
I think so.
But thanks for being here, Josh and Mom.
See you later.
See you later.
Bye.